From VOA, the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. Here's your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Welcome to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. September 12th is the sixth-month anniversary of the World Health Organization declaring COVID-19 a global pandemic. According to the Center for Systems Science and Engineering at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland, nearly 28 million cases and 900,000 deaths of COVID-19 have been reported globally since then. Public health agencies throughout the world set out to address and mitigate the effects of this global health emergency. On May 29th, U.S. President Donald Trump announced the United States would terminate its relationship with the World Health Organization, an agency of the United Nations responsible for international public health.
China has total control over the World Health Organization, despite only paying $40 million per year, compared to what the United States has been paying, which is approximately $450 million a year. We have detailed the reforms that it must make and engage with them directly, but they have refused to act. Because they have failed to make the requested and greatly needed reforms, we will be today terminating our relationship with the World Health Organization and redirecting those funds to other worldwide and deserving urgent global public health needs.
According to a senior official with the Trump administration, the United States actions at the WHO do not affect the level of our country's overall global health assistance. The administration official said that the United States leads the world in health and humanitarian aid, are committed to ensuring our nation's generosity directly reaches people around the world, and that the U.S. accounts for more than 40% of total global health funding. At a recent campaign rally in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, President Donald Trump spoke about his administration's efforts in mitigating the pandemic in the United States and that a new COVID-19 vaccine is being produced in record time.
When the virus arrived, we launched the largest national mobilization since World War II. We're delivering life-saving therapies, and we have achieved some of the great numbers, the case fatality rates. We have the lowest of any major country in the world. People don't know that because the fake news doesn't want to write about it. Under Operation Warp Speed, we're producing a vaccine in record time. This is a vaccine that we're going to have very soon, very, very soon, by the end of the year, but much sooner than that, perhaps. And this is something that's incredible. This would have taken 2 or 3 years by the last administration, and in all fairness, by most other administrations. We have upped it to a level that nobody even believes is possible and totally safe.
On today's Science Edition of Press Conference USA, we'll look at how the pandemic took root and immediately impacted the lives of people all around the world. We'll examine some of the steps and missteps that have been taken to address the COVID-19 pandemic, the development of vaccines to prevent the disease, and therapies to treat it in the world's scientific laboratories. And we'll address the new reality of surviving and even thriving with the threat of this deadly disease. VOA health reporter Carol Pearson joins me again today as co-host for the program. Our guest is Dr. Peter Hotez, Dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, co-director of the Texas Children's Hospital Center for Vaccine Development, and is also a pediatrician and author. His latest book is Preventing the Next Pandemic, Vaccine Diplomacy in a Time of Anti-Science. Dr. Hotez, you appeared on this program twice during the first couple of months during the pandemic, and you provided us with insight on what we should expect from the pandemic. From what you expected to happen at the beginning of the pandemic to now, how do aspects of what's actually happening compare?
I think all of the surprises, unfortunately, are disappointing and tragic, and there are very few, if any, pleasant surprises here. Almost everything's a negative. So let's go through it. Number one, the fact that the G20 nations, which were the ones that were hit initially in this first part of the epidemic, handled it very poorly overall, particularly in the Western Hemisphere, the U.S., Mexico, Brazil. G20 nations that should have been able to handle and manage this pandemic failed miserably. The human tragedy that was allowed to occur in these G20 countries was profound and unnecessary. The second very disappointing aspect of this was the collapse of global governance. You know, we're in a situation now where it almost appears like it's every nation for themselves and making one-off arrangements now with pharmaceutical companies, with individual actors, all of our usual sense of global governance, working through the United Nations agencies such as the World Health Organization, UNICEF, Gavi seems to be breaking down and slowing or halting or even reversing some of our global health gains because of it. And I did not expect that to happen. And this is a pandemic that has gone way beyond the bounds of what I thought might happen.
Dr. Otez, we were talking about some of the global health agencies. I want to get your opinion here. What kind of job do you think public health organizations are doing during this crisis?
Well, they're a different set of circumstances. With regards to the Health and Human Services agencies, also very disappointing in their overall performance. In the past, the Health and Human Services agencies, NIH, CDC, FDA, you know, have been always been able to insulate themselves from White House incursions. So this is not new that the White House would attempt to meddle. This has been going on for decades. But the agencies have always been strong enough to kind of hold the line and prevent too much disruption. That's not happened this time around. Clearly, I mean, the NIH overall seems pretty well insulated with the leadership of people like Francis Collins and Tony Fauci and that next layer down that's been with them forever. I think they've done a really good job resisting those incursions. This not happened, though, with the CDC and FDA. So I don't really understand exactly what's going on. It will take a commission to figure this out. But clearly, the CDC has been either invisible for much of this pandemic, or when they are visible, it's giving out information that doesn't make any sense or seems to not be based on the science. And this is extraordinary from an agency that prides itself on being science-driven. And the FDA's done a little better, maybe, but even they've, you know, we've had some terrible gaffes with the emergency use authorization about hydroxychloroquine, and the communication around the Operation Warp Speed vaccines has been very poor as well. So this has also been another big issue with the Health and Human Services agencies. And as I said, with the UN agencies, I think they're doing, I think, the best hand given the circumstances that they're working under. But I think it does reveal how important United States leadership has been to the successes in global health governance over the last 20 years. And there has been a lot of successes. And I've written about this in a new book called Preventing the Next Pandemic. I go through in detail some of the great successes around vaccine-preventable diseases, working with Gavi, and the global goals around neglected tropical disease control, malaria, TB, HIV/AIDS. And now I worry it's unraveling, and it really does go to show the importance of how critical U.S. leadership is and what happens when it pulls out.
Recently, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention advised that people who have been exposed to the coronavirus but don't have symptoms shouldn't get tested. But then, in a recent email to VOA, CDC Director Dr. Robert Redfield said the agency is, quote, placing emphasis on testing individuals with symptomatic illness, individuals with a significant exposure, vulnerable populations, including nursing homes or long care facilities, critical infrastructure workers, healthcare workers, and first responders, or those individuals who may be asymptomatic when prioritized by medical and public health officials, end quote. Redfield's statement said, quote, testing is meant to drive actions and achieve specific public health objectives. Everyone who needs a COVID-19 test can get a test. Everyone who wants a test does not necessarily need a test. The key is to engage the needed public health community in the decision with appropriate follow-up action, end quote. Dr. Hotez, what are your thoughts?
Well, this has been sort of the ongoing saga of either inaction or a misstep that then has to be walked back. And again, how much of this is coming out from above versus sort of internal chaos is really hard to sort out. But it doesn't help the American people feel secure. We've always depended on a really strong CDC to give us profound health advice and also to take, you know, assertive action in something like preventing this epidemic. I mean, this is what the CDC was set up for first and foremost. The U.S. has been the epicenter of this pandemic almost since the beginning. We have more cases and more deaths than any other nation. And even currently, right now, we still have more new cases and new deaths than any other nation. So we've been at the epicenter of this pandemic, and we continue to be at the epicenter of this pandemic. And exactly what's gone so terribly wrong, what's the problem with the agencies, what's the problem with the White House, we still don't know.
Toward the beginning of the pandemic, Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, said time and time again that it would be a year or even longer for a COVID-19 vaccine to be released. The president has been talking about a vaccine that could be released as early as October or November, and some people have expressed concerns that vaccines perhaps will not be safe because they may not have gone through the same amount of testing as previously approved vaccines. President Trump at the North Carolina rally assured the public that the vaccines indeed will be very safe.
The vaccine will be safe. These are the greatest companies in the world that do this, the greatest labs, the greatest doctors. It'll be effective, and it'll be delivered before the end of the year. And maybe, as I said, much sooner than that.
Dr. Hotez, what are your thoughts concerning the timeline of the release of a COVID-19 vaccine?
Yeah, I mean, I've been really sticking to the same time frame now for a few months on you know, going on cable news networks saying I see this as third quarter 2021 before we'll release vaccines to the public. Dr. Fauci has been pretty consistent saying Q1, Q2 2021. And then I say, well, okay, Tony says this. I'm saying that. Let's split the difference sometime in the middle of 2021. And now all of a sudden, we're hearing about in a few weeks, the vaccines are going to be released possibly through an emergency use authorization mechanism. And that gives me a lot of concern because the emergency use authorization mechanism was never really intended for something like a vaccine to be delivered to a large segment of the U.S. population. We use EUAs for things like PPE or ventilators, but not for a product that's going to be administered to millions of healthy Americans to prevent them from getting sick. So we've never used an EUA mechanism for vaccines on this scale, number one. And number two, you know, the EUA ultimately is a substandard or a second-rate review, and that's not something you do for a vaccine given to a large segment of the population, especially for vaccines that use a brand new technology, such as an mRNA vaccine that has never been licensed before. So to be honest with you, I don't really know what's going on. I'm hearing different things from different agencies. We'll see how this unfolds. I can't imagine having the safety and efficacy data in hand before the election in order to release a vaccine. I just don't see a path by which that happens.
Dr. Hotez, not all vaccines that come to market work. How will these, if there's no phase three trial or no phase two trial, I mean, how do you figure that these vaccines will be safe and effective? And is that a concern, especially if healthcare workers are among the first to get them?
Well, I think the whole point is any vaccine that's licensed by the FDA both works and is safe. And we've got this well-tested mechanism for assuring that only effective and safe vaccines get released to the public. And it's, you know, been worked out over decades. And that's why I'm a strong proponent of working through the current licensing system by the FDA and not circumventing it, because I don't know what you get at that point. So I again, there's just too little known about what people mean by emergency use authorization of a vaccine and how much of it's going to be based on scientific evidence to really say at this point. So the bottom line is any vaccine that goes through the full licensure process, even if it's an expedited review, I feel very comfortable taking that vaccine myself or giving it to family members. Anything less than that, all I can say is I guess I would have to see what the phase three data looks like myself and then make an assessment.
The U.S. Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee held hearings at the U.S. Capitol on Wednesday. Vaccines, saving lives, ensuring confidence, and protecting public health. National Institutes of Health Director Dr. Francis Collins was a hearing witness. He assured the committee members that decisions to evaluate any forthcoming vaccines will be based on science.
I'm a scientist. I've had the privilege of serving as the NIH director for 11 years. I can't say strongly enough that the decisions about how this vaccine is going to be evaluated and assessed is going to be based on science. And I know I speak for my colleagues in the government and certainly for the scientific community broadly, that that can be the only basis upon which this decision is made. Otherwise, the public would not be expected to trust us. So that will be the only measure. Will it be done by a certain date? I could not possibly tell you right now because I don't know what's going to happen. Right. Coming months. I do have cautious optimism that by the end of 2020, at least one of these vaccines will have emerged and turned out to be safe and effective. But even that is a guess. And certainly to try to predict whether it happens on a particular week before or after a particular date in early November, well beyond anything that any scientist right now could tell you and be confident that they know what they're saying.
That was National Institutes of Health Director Dr. Francis Collins.
Dr. Hotez, you mentioned your next book, which is Preventing the Next Pandemic. As you know, there's an anti-vax movement. People have become very wary of vaccines. Yet we have two vaccines in the U.S. that are in the works, and the White House says that they will be out possibly before November. So how do you convince people in this anti-vax movement or people who in this anti-science feeling that these vaccines, if they are safe, are life-saving?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The anti-vaccine movement has grown dramatically. In my last book, Vaccines Did Not Cause Rachel's Autism, I pointed how the modern rise really took off starting in the election of 2016, even the year before, around 2015, there was this new pivot to the far right, and they started getting a lot of funding from the far-right political forces in the United States, especially here in Texas, where I live and work. And now it's tragically become a full-blown anti-science movement. So what started out with vaccines are now about under this banner of what they call health freedom, this fake concept, health freedom or medical freedom. They're glomming onto it, campaigns against masks and contact tracing. And it's one of the reasons why we have such a terrible epidemic here in the United States. And the other piece to this, and I've talked about this before on VOA, I'm very concerned about the globalization of this American anti-vaccine movement. And now we're seeing that in full force. Last weekend, we saw demonstrations in Berlin, Germany, being led by some of the same ringleaders of the anti-vaccine movement in the U.S. So this is now a full-on globalized anti-science movement, capitalizing on the weaknesses in global governance and also capitalizing on the missteps around messaging around Operation Warp Speed vaccine. Each agency has a different spin on it, with the CDC, for instance, saying that they're going to get ready to release vaccines right ahead of a couple of days before the election. And then on CNN, Francis Collins from the NIH thankfully walked it back a bit and said, no, we're going to wait till we have all of the full data from the phase three trial. But the American people are left scratching their heads saying, well, what exactly is going on? And of course, the anti-vaccine movement, what they do is they're like sitting around like a bunch of lions on the savannah watching an injured impala waiting, and it's not going to go well, unfortunately.
Let's take a break now. You're listening to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Here's a reminder that Press Conference USA is available for free download from our website, voanews.com/PCUSA, and from many streaming services such as Apple Podcasts. If you have access to the Internet, please check out our Facebook and Twitter pages at Carol Castiel, VOA, for alerts and program updates. Let's get back to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. September 12th is the six-month anniversary of the World Health Organization declaring COVID-19 a global pandemic. Today, we're looking at how the pandemic took root and immediately impacted the lives of people around the world. VOA Health reporter Carol Pearson is my co-host for the program. Our guest is Dr. Peter Hotez, Dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, co-director of Texas Children's Hospital Center for Vaccine Development, and is also a pediatrician and author. His latest book is Preventing the Next Pandemic, Vaccine Diplomacy in a Time of Anti-Science. Dr. Hotez, a recent report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention stirred up a bit of controversy. It noted that 94% of all COVID-19 fatalities from February 1st through August 22nd included some comorbidity factors such as influenza, pneumonia, respiratory failure, hypertension, diabetes, and cardiac arrest. Some people took that to mean that only 6% died solely due to COVID-19. Is that a proper interpretation of the numbers? What are your thoughts?
The deal is this. I believe it's quite likely that more than 90% of people who perish from COVID-19 do have comorbidities such as high blood pressure or diabetes or obesity or underlying renal conditions. That does not surprise me. The misstatement or the misleading component of this is to say that they didn't die of COVID. They clearly died of COVID-19. They had underlying conditions. But, you know, that's true of most infectious diseases. Most infectious diseases that kill with comorbidities. That's true of influenza. That's true of dengue. That's true of so many other illnesses. So the fact that this is used to sort of diminish the importance of COVID-19 is really troubling.
When the CDC puts out a number of so many deaths, those are the only deaths that have been attributed to COVID and are confirmed. But there's a possibility that a lot more people have died because people die without always being confirmed.
That's right. And so the organizations like the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation have looked at unaccounted for deaths. And what they do is they compare the year 2020 with previous years and will show a rise in deaths that are unattributed to currently to COVID-19, but which likely could be. So for instance, you have EMS gets called to a house and someone has died of sudden death. That might be ascribed to a heart attack or a stroke and not realizing that in fact that those things were actually generated by COVID-19 because this is a vascular disease. It causes thrombotic events in the heart, in the vasculature, in the brain, and pulmonary emboli. So a lot of the sudden deaths that the emergency services are seeing at home are in fact due to COVID-19, and it's going to take time to actually ascribe it to COVID-19. So some are saying the number of deaths in the U.S. has already reached 200,000 or more. Currently, the number is put at about 185,000 with the expectation by the end of September we'll reach 200,000. But others would say we've already surpassed that mark based on consideration of those circumstances.
Dr. Hotez, how long do you think we're going to have to deal with the issue of the coronavirus? Some people have put the number at decades. How long of a time frame are we looking at?
Well, it's hard to predict. You know, you have the models coming out of Harvard School of Public Health from Mark Lipsitch, who's showing seasonal peaks in January for the next 4 or 5 years, and I think that's a possibility. If we get several vaccines up and running and administer to a large segment of the global population, that clearly will have some mitigating effect. So I think it's going to be a bit of a competition between multiple things. One, it's going to see what those seasonal waves look like in the out years. That's going to be a factor. Second, how we do with vaccinating the world's population. But third, we've got a lot of other competing social determinants. You know, you can't vaccinate easily in places of war, political collapse or instability, or because of some of these populist regimes, other factors such as urbanization, the anti-science movements. And then that's what my new book is about. It basically says we're in this epic struggle between vaccination and these forces. And the book is called Preventing the Next Pandemic, Vaccine Diplomacy in an Age of Anti-Science. And you get the message right there that there is indeed this, what I call this epic struggle going on between positive forces such as administering a vaccine and all these other things that we're now looking at.
We've been talking about vaccines, but what about treatments? Are there any treatments out there that look promising?
I think so. You know, right now, plasma therapy, convalescent plasma therapy is being disparaged. I actually think it needs another look, particularly if you control for using plasma in large amounts with high titered antibody. I think that still works. We just, you know, and there are some limited randomized clinical trials. I think the way the program rolled out under the expanded access program was never meant to really address questions of whether or not it works, but I think it probably does. So there's that. But also, I think we're always recognized that plasma is a stopgap measure for what we really want in between that and a vaccine, and that is monoclonal antibody therapies, which I'm pretty excited about. I think those are going to be really important game changers for treating sick individuals. The monoclonal antibody cocktail coming out of Regeneron or coming out of AbCellera, collaboration with Lilly, I think those are going to be important treatments as well. And we still have new antiviral drugs. And don't forget, we are doing better at getting patients out of the ICU. I mean, we do things we haven't done before, such as recognizing this is a vascular injury and insult and causing thrombotic events. So we're putting them on anticoagulant therapy, giving them dexamethasone, giving them convalescent plasma. All these things are getting patients out of the ICU faster.
Dr. Hotez, a new report suggests that cheap, widely available steroid drugs reduce the number of deaths in the sickest patients with COVID-19, according to a trio of newly published clinical trials. And the WHO endorses steroids as a life-saving treatment for COVID-19. Your thoughts about that?
Yeah, that's why I mentioned dexamethasone in my last statement. I think that seems to be important, because there's two phases to this viral infection. One is the initial direct injury from the virus, and this is why you use monoclonal antibodies. This is why you use a vaccine to prevent infection. But then after the virus is in your system for a period of time, what's happening, it's triggering the release of cytokines and chemokines, what some people refer to as cytokine storm, and that's causing a lot of tissue damage. So I think what the steroids do is mitigate some of that tissue damage. And I think that's why you're seeing a positive impact from steroids.
You mentioned the cytokine storm, but not everybody understands what that is. Could you explain it? And also monoclonal antibodies, not everybody understands what that is. Could you just give us brief definitions?
Sure. Cytokine storm refers to the release of a number of molecules that come from our own white blood cells that cause things like instability in blood pressure, and also themselves can have some toxicities. And so what you see with serious infectious disease, whether it's virus or bacterial infections, is the initial wave coming directly from the invasion by the bacteria, the virus, and then there's that host inflammatory response, which when you have intubated patients is sometimes referred to as cytokine storm.
Dr. Hotez, countries that had initial success in mitigating COVID-19 infections are now seeing high rates of infections. For example, South Korea and some European nations who had pretty much flatlined the infection rate are now coming back gangbusters. Does this mean we're seeing a second wave of infections, or is this technically still the first wave?
I don't think we really know. You know, the fact that those countries did such a great job makes me concerned that what you're seeing is reintroduction of the virus. And it just illustrates how difficult it is to contain this virus. So even with all hands on deck, with the proper leadership at the federal level, this is still a tough one to fight. So I feel pretty confident that countries like South Korea and some of the European countries will be able to recontain this. It does bring hardships. This is a tough virus. And hopefully a year from now, we'll have begun vaccinating a significant percentage of the population, including a vaccine that we've developed. We've developed a low-cost recombinant protein vaccine for COVID-19 that's now being scaled in India. It's being done by a large Indian pharmaceutical organization called Biological E, or they call themselves BioE, with plans to make 1 billion doses of this vaccine. And the exciting part is it uses the same technology used to make the recombinant hepatitis B vaccine that's made in countries all over the world and can be done for $1 or $2 a dose in some case. So our hope that is a COVID-19 vaccine that we've developed at Baylor College of Medicine and Texas Children's Hospital might have an important impact on this terrible pandemic.
Dr. Hotez, I want to thank you so much for taking time from your incredibly busy schedule to talk with us today.
Well, thanks so much for having me. And, you know, unfortunately, this is going to be around for a while. And, you know, maybe we could do a refresh in a month and we'll see where we're at that point.
That was Dr. Peter Hotez, the Dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. He's the co-director of the Texas Children's Hospital Center for Vaccine Development and also a pediatrician and author. His latest book is Preventing the Next Pandemic, Vaccine Diplomacy in a Time of Anti-Science. Dr. Hotez joined us today via Skype. I'd like to thank VOA senior health reporter Carol Pearson for co-hosting today's program with me. Also, thanks to VOA White House correspondents Patsy Wiedekuswara and Steve Herman. This is Rick Pantaleo. Thanks for listening today, and please be sure to join Carol Castillo again next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.